Much. If you've got your Bibles, let's turn to John 8. We're going to start a new series and start with this passage. Just as we're turning there, can I mention that Ruth and Islam were part of this church for many, many years. In fact, Ruth must be one of our longest standing members. And so she turns 90 this week. And so we just wanted to wish her all of it. Sorry? Yesterday, thank you. I'm getting kept right here by Rosie. She turned 90 yesterday. We just wanted to wish her all the best in terms of her birthday and to celebrate that. As a church, we're kind of beginning to emerge out of 2 years of COVID, and obviously that's had a massive impact on church life, and no church, certainly in my living memory and probably in recent history, has really experienced the 2 years that we've had. And really, we don't know what the journey looks like and what rebuilding and what kind of church reappears and reemerges after the last 2 years. But certainly we know that it is one of the most challenging times for the life of any congregation or church. And there are various things that we recognize as challenges. So one of the challenges that we see is certainly in terms of resourcing, in terms of individuals and volunteers. And obviously it's good as people come back to church. Hopefully that addresses some of the volunteering. We also have resourcing challenges in terms of financing. And the fact that for 2 years that there was no real open offerings in church, and that makes a significant impact in terms of church life, but it also makes significant impact in terms of people's patterns of giving. And last week our treasurer was sharing the budget that we've got to meet. We've got a gift day on the 20th of March, and we'll be writing to everybody and letting you know. But just so you're aware, there are challenges in terms of finances. As part of that, we're also looking at ways to make it easier for people to give. And if you go downstairs, you'll notice we now have a machine that accepts cards. Now, I know for some of you, this will be like, oh, what's happening? But for a lot of us, we don't carry cards anymore. In fact, some of us don't even carry, we don't carry cash anymore. Some of us don't even carry cards. We just use our phones. And Alec was very keen last week that I tried it out with my phone and found out it does work with your phone as well. And but it's just a simple way to give. And there are actually other ways that you can use it as well. So for instance, you know, even in terms of coffee time and things like that, you know, rather than we're giving it to you, you don't have to pay for it. But if you would like to make a contribution towards your coffee, just like you would if you were going to a shop, then, you know, that's a good thing to do. And all of these factors help us in terms of our finances. And again, it's one of the significant challenges that we face as we move into what is an interesting year in terms of 2022. The third element that I'm very aware of as we come out of COVID is the need for Christian mission, maybe more than ever. Maybe what's happened with COVID will shake the church out of its complacency, and I mean church, big C, but maybe small C as well, and cause us to re-engage in what mission means, and not to be inward-looking, but outward-looking and focused. And as we do that, apologetics is really important, the ability to defend our faith and explain our faith. And one of the things I'm aware of, I've been asked to do some work with some young people, is there are so many questions out there that people are asking now. And people are wondering about their faith. And actually, challenges to faith are not anything new. And what I want to do over the next 6 weeks is look at what Jesus's critics said about him. And look at the various accusations that were made in relation to him. You'll see in the end of that passage that we're reading in John's Gospel, that actually in verse 48, they turn around and they say, "You're a Samaritan and demon-possessed," which were pretty harsh, critical things to say in relation to Jesus, but he was being accused. And an accusation in relation to Jesus, and there are a whole series of them in the New Testament and in the Gospels, and we're going to look at some of these accusations, were part and parcel of Jesus' ministry. And it continues to be part and parcel of what Christianity has to do. Because we have to go out and we have to, people have a perception of Christianity. They have a perception of the church. They have a perception of Christians. And we have to address this and address the sort of things that people say. And I often hear people talking about Christians. And I hear them talking about the church. And I just go, that is not the church or the Christianity that I recognize. And I think part of emerging out of COVID is going to be the need for us to be able to defend our faith and a new apologetic. And I'm hoping that through this series, we'll begin to grapple with that. In the after Easter, we'll start to look again at mission in the workplace and as a retired person and what it means for us to witness to Christ where we are, and we're going to explore that in terms of whole life discipleship. But I want to just do this apologetic thing. It also means that we'll engage a little bit with history as well, and as we think about it, move towards the cross and Easter. One of the things that you learn quickly in life is that there is a distinction between perceptions and reality. Sometimes things are presented better than they are. sometimes they're presented worse than they are. But often there is a correlation or an incongruity between what people perceive and what actually is. This is why in the Old Testament, to slander someone was considered a fairly serious sin. Because actually, to slander someone was to shape and change perception. And often that perception became the reality in our world. We're facing some massive challenges in terms of perception versus reality. One of the things I've been really concerned of just in the last few days, and again, this is my own personal opinion, but is in a kind of righteous anger, some of the excesses that it feels like our government and our society are even engaging in terms of the Russian peoples. You know, I imagine some of the things that are being said and done to Russians, that we were doing those things to Jews. I mean, it's fairly stark. One of the things I find most terrifying is that our government this week decided to ban a TV and radio station that was working with the Russian government. But suddenly they decided that the West could no longer have access to that media, just while Russia was deciding that their population could no longer have access to certain media, because the reporting in our country is so unbiased and objective that, of course, anything that reflects any kind of bias. And you kind of look at what's happening there, and you're like, wow, we used to believe in the freedom of the press, and I guess that's a consequence of COVID and some of the things that we've seen and the excesses that we've seen in terms of COVID and behaviors of governments that is kind of shaping our world. And I just think there needs to be a caution. But what is all that about? It's about the relationship of perception versus reality and who shapes the perceptions. And people understand that perception versus reality is a critical thing. And people want to shape the perceptions. All the time, we should always be challenging our perceptions and questioning our perceptions. But it's a dangerous thing. One of the things that is happening in our culture is, in fact, that people are saying perception is everything and there is no such thing as reality. Again, this week, we saw our government in Scotland considering legislation in terms of the gender recognition bill. And doing this despite equalities commissions having serious reservations about progressing this at the moment, many, many women's groups objecting and saying, do you understand what this is going to mean for women? But again, if you drill down in what was happening, it's saying that a perception, you know, how you decide to perceive yourself, it will become the reality. This is what's happening. It's an issue of perception versus reality. And again, a very serious thing. You know, this relationship between perception and reality, just as I'm saying in terms of media, in terms of things like gender recognition, it is really serious. But it's also really, really serious in terms of what it can do to an individual. My daughter works for a big legal company, one of the largest legal practices in the world, actually. And her firm have been caught up in some of the stuff that have been getting said about Russians. And we were sitting chatting this, and the Daily Mail, the Daily Mail, not the Sunday Mail, decided to run an article on the lawyers involved with the Russians. And I read it with my daughter yesterday. And again, the whole perception that was in the article vis-a-vis the reality, I know the reality, is like so divergent. And yet, it's probably going to cost that company millions and millions of pounds in terms of business. Perception versus reality. It's an interesting thing. It happens in the church, perception versus reality. It happened with Jesus. And so in considering this, it's a big question. As a historian, see David's here, but you know, some people think that history is the recording of events, and that's what history is. But actually, you never just record the events. You never just record the raw data. You always interpret the events. So it's not just the events, it's the perception of the events. And whoever writes the history, then you read their perceptions of those events. And so this relationship between reality and perception is a very important thing. It's very important in terms of slander. Because if you slander someone, if you say negative things about an individual, you shape the perception of how that individual is perceived. Jesus, during his ministry, was being shaped by the things and the slanders that were being said about him. So people weren't just coming with a level playing field and evaluating what he was saying. They weren't evaluating his teaching. It was actually being shaped by the slanders that were being rendered towards him. So, and you see it very clearly in John chapter 8. So the slander that this is a demoniac speaking, or this is a Samaritan that is speaking, was shaping how people viewed what Jesus said. So they didn't evaluate the truth of what Jesus was saying. They were writing him off before even listening to him. Why? Because of the slander that was being put out there. And for Christians, it's one of the things that we have to deal with is that there is a perception of Christianity. And over the last decade, that perception has become increasingly negative. I mean, before COVID, the direction of the dialogue on Christianity, it was terrifying, actually, the direction. I don't know what it will look like post-COVID, but certainly what was being said and the way that Christianity was being portrayed was terrible. You know, and again, I come back to issues in terms of gender recognition. You know, you could no longer, and again, even mentioning this subject this morning is seen as controversial. But you could not make comment about gender or what was being happening in the public forum without being branded and slandered as prejudiced in some way, as trying to repress people. Immediately, before the arguments are even heard, this was what was happening. And again, in a society where we're less and less in touch with reality, perception becomes a terrifying thing. People can get persecuted on the basis of perception. It was happening to Jesus. And the accusation I want to consider this morning that was happening in terms of Jesus was he was being accused of being illegitimate. We actually see it here in John's Gospel, and I'll come and look at it. Sorry, if we can go back to the other slide. We see it happening here in John's Gospel. But we know that there was an irregularity in Jesus' birth. Matthew records it. I had a lecturer once who didn't believe in the virgin birth. And he was trying to say that Matthew didn't believe in the virgin birth. I didn't have a problem with him not believing in it, but the idea that Matthew didn't believe it, I was like, that's really stretching it. And I remember asking him, as he said, of course, Matthew didn't believe in the virgin birth. I went, if he didn't believe in the virgin birth, how come he was so surprised when Mary got pregnant? And it was like, oh, okay. Anyway, but Matthew records that it was an irregularity in Jesus' birth. You actually see it very cleverly in the genealogy right at the start of Matthew. That genealogy, most people skip it, but it's really interesting because it's very distinctive. And one of the things that's really distinctive in the genealogy is that Matthew mentions four women. Normally, women wouldn't appear in a genealogy, but Matthew puts four women into the genealogy. He puts a woman called Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and the wife of Uriah, who we know as Bathsheba. And so he mentions these four women in the genealogy. And it would be really weird to put women in, but he does. But it's the type of women. All of these women had morally, their reputation morally wasn't the best. And some of them are attributed with being prostitutes. One's an adulteress. The other one would probably be portrayed as maybe a gold digger, and so forth. And we have these four women here. And the thing is, Mary then appears in the list as well. But Matthew's point is that maybe from outside people have these perceptions of these women, but the reality was that God was working through them. But nonetheless, by doing that, Matthew is saying there was something irregular in Jesus' birth. You'll know because you've heard me talk about it a lot in Luke's gospel. When it talks about an inn, it doesn't mean an inn. It actually was to do with the fact that Joseph's family was saying when Jesus was born, he had to be born in the stable with the animals because he couldn't be born in the house. And again, why was that? Because there was something irregular about Jesus' birth. And the family didn't want to be associated with it. And Luke's point in the birth narrative is that Jesus was somehow being rejected. He was being ostracized. As we've been looking at the last few weeks, he was someone who was on the margins, again, to do with his birth. We see it as well, and there's controversy among scholars, many because they don't want to admit that maybe we find the idea of the irregularity of Jesus' birth in the other Gospels, but I think we do in Mark chapter 6, verse 3. Jesus is called the Son of Mary. Very unusual. You wouldn't normally be called Son of Mary. You'd normally be called after your father. So the fact that they say Son of Mary, and a number of scholars believe that actually it was an insult. It was an implication. When Matthew picks up on the story, he actually changes it. And it kind of shows you, you ask, why did Matthew change it? Because he was maybe a bit embarrassed about, and he changes it to the son of the carpenter in Matthew 13. So it suggests that there was something up with that statement, son of Mary. And then in John 8, we don't quite pick it up in our English translations, but in the Greek, it's really clear in verse 41, where the opponents of Jesus say, we are not illegitimate. And the implication and the inference is, as you are. So there's actually an implication in John 8 that Jesus is illegitimate. And so there is this accusation. He is an illegitimate son. And this was what was being said. Now, in terms of that, that was a pretty serious accusation in first century Palestine. As being accused of being an illegitimate son was a form of denouncing Jesus. He was actually claiming that Jesus is not a legitimate Israelite male, and therefore his teaching and his mission and his vision are to be called into question. Even to this day, and I haven't been to a football match for a wee while, but I do know that sometimes the parentage of referees is called into question after certain decisions. So I believe, and again, it's an accusation. It's actually an attempt to slander someone, and you know, and in our day and age, it's sometimes used, but in Jesus' day and age, it was a massive accusation, and it was rooted into Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 2 that we read. Again, some of the passages that we're going to be reading over the next few weeks from the Old Testament are wild. And you read them and think, how on earth does this relate to Christianity? And it's one of the questions I often get asked, which is, somebody will read something about war, for instance, from Judges or something like that, and they'll say, well, look, doesn't this say that we have to go out and kill people and do all this? And I always have to remind people that as Christians, we always read the Old Testament in the light of the New Testament. And so if you just take the Old Testament and read it and apply it without the New Testament, you will be in serious trouble. You have to start with the New Testament and then reinterpret and understand what the Old Testament is saying in the light of the New Testament. And it's very important that you do that, because if you don't, Christianity turns into something that it isn't. And we lose actually what Jesus was doing in bringing the message in the gospel to us. Anyway, that's the sideline. So in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 2, we read about these laws relating to people who are to be excluded. Sorry, can we go to the next slide? Who are to be excluded from the congregation of the Lord. And it says in verse 2, no one misgotten shall be admitted into the congregation of the Lord. And there's been a lot of debate about who does that mean. Does it mean people of mixed marriages? That would certainly be the context. But in Judaism, it was extended to anybody who is the product of incest or any form of prohibited sexual union, or even maybe the offspring of an apostate. If your dad was seen as a heretic of some sort, then maybe that was it. And the idea is that anybody who comes from any questionable background and whose origins cannot be verified, then actually there's maybe a point of exclusion. Scholars debate about how extreme this was in Jesus' time. There's a man called Bruce Kilton, and he's a New Testament scholar, and he says it was massive. He says it means Jesus couldn't marry, he was on the fringes of religious life, his voice was silenced, and he argues that it was the reason he was forced from Nazareth, because he actually couldn't demonstrate that he had solid origins. And so he tried to move out of the town where people knew about his origins to Capernaum, where they didn't know about his origins. Other scholars argue that maybe it wasn't quite severe. Can we go to the next slide? And they suggest that maybe the issue with Jesus' origins was offset by things that happened in his life. We're told by Matthew's very clear that Joseph adopted him as his son. And if you read the genealogy, the inference is that Jesus was Joseph's adopted son. That's what Matthew's kind of portraying. And some think that may legitimize Jesus in some way. Others think that John's baptism may have legitimized Jesus in some way, that baptism was seen as a break from the past, as we were saying last week. Others believe that if you got the right teaching and you became a really good teacher, that would obfuscate your origins and that discipleship and teaching. And again, you find all of this in the teaching of rabbis and in the suggestions. So we aren't entirely sure about the severity. There is a strong case to be put forward that Jesus would not be allowed to marry because of questions over his legitimacy. You just couldn't find a partner. And some people think that may be an element in Jesus' singleness. What is for sure is that this accusation and this slander must have dug deep. Now, to question someone's origins. In Scotland, or in Scottish Irish history, you know that we have MacDonald or MacPherson, and the Mac means son of. And that your identity is derived from your family. Well, in the Near East, in first century Near East, that was massive. Your identity derived from your family. And so when people challenged your legitimacy, they challenged the very core of your identity, who you were. And again, sometimes we get this image of Jesus as this divine figure, an unmoved mover moving through the world. But what we've just done in communion recognizes that Jesus was human. And that these slanderous things would have hurt. They would have actually impacted him and his ministry. Again, Kilton argues that the psychological impact of this on Jesus maybe was the reason that his teaching was so orientated towards the margins, because he himself was on the margins. And again, it's an interesting speculation. Truth is, we can't definitively answer the questions about how did this impact Jesus? What was the social religious setting that Jesus was ministering in? And how did this slander impact? But it probably did impact. However, we can see how Jesus answers the slanders. And so in John 8, we see how Jesus answers those who call him illegitimate. Or rather, let's start at Mark 6. So in Mark 6, we see how Jesus answers those who call him illegitimate in Mark chapter 6. And if you read the story in Mark chapter 6, this whole group come together in the town of Nazareth, and they begin to say, who is this guy that's teaching? And people begin to say, well, he's the son of Mary. And they end up rejecting his teaching. And Jesus goes on to say, in the famous proverb, he says, a prophet is without honor in his own land. And the point he's making in Mark chapter 6, and then even more scarily, he actually goes on to say that Jesus was not able to work. He wasn't able to do many miracles in that situation. You see, Jesus was warning them, and he says, our prejudice can often blind us. You know, the truth is the truth, but our prejudice can often blind us. And sometimes when, and again, we must always be careful of this when we slander people or when we distort people in terms of slanders rather than on the basis of evaluating what they say or don't say, that we can often not see what God is doing because of our prejudice. You know, sometimes we meet people and we write them off in terms of ministry, maybe because of the way that they appear, maybe because of the way that they speak, maybe because they don't share the same background as us. And we write them off, and what we fail to do is see that God can work through this individual. And the scary thing is, in Mark 6, is that Jesus is saying, because you're writing me off, I can't work in the way I want to work. And that sometimes slanders hinders the work of God in our churches because our prejudices suppress our ability to see that God can work through this individual. And so it's always a thing to evaluate, you know, especially how we react and respond. And we're all, if you do any form of teaching in an academic setting nowadays, you have to go through all this unconscious bias courses and various other things. And although sometimes you think, oh, what's this about? You know, the truth is, though, that often we allow our prejudices to shape our realities. And by doing that, we hinder the work of God. So when you find yourself writing somebody off, or when you find yourself listening to a slander or something about a person, ask yourself, you know, is this true? And more deeply, am I actually hindering the work of God by entertaining this slander? Second thing that Jesus then shows is he says, it's not our past, it's the present. In John chapter 8, the dialogue is all about, who's your father? And Jesus argues, and this is what he says. He says, who your father is, and they were claiming Abraham as their father, it's not to do with your religious heritage or your biological heritage. It's to do with your moral heritage or how you act. This is what Jesus is saying. And he's saying, you guys are showing that your father is Satan. And you're going, whoa. And he's saying, the reason you're showing that your father is Satan is because you are lying and you want to kill me. And he says, guess who lies and guess who wants to kill? He says, Satan. So when you entertain lies and you entertain that kind of degree of animosity, then you are the children of Satan. That's like, whoa. And he says, but when you are open to God and when you tell the truth and when you serve the higher purposes of love, no matter your background, no matter your origins, then you are a child of God. And so his answer is, It's not about the past. It's not about your education. It's not about your lineage. It's not about whether you're a Baptist or a Presbyterian or an Orthodox. It's about how you behave now and how you live out your faith. Are you a person of truth? Do you reflect the love of God? Do you actually accept people and embrace people the way that God embraces people? And so when people say, oh, you're illegitimate in your origins, Jesus says, well, look, just look at what you're doing now, and we can see who your father is. And look at what I'm doing, and you can see who my father is. And it's a powerful answer to that slander. Follow the way of truth and love. And lastly, in John 8, we see the idea that God works through anyone open to his spirit. Again, it's an extenuation. It's an extension of that same thought, which is, you know, as you act in the way of love, as you act speaking the truth, then the Spirit of God works through you. The Spirit of God doesn't come along and say, oh, you went to Edinburgh University, so I'll now work through you. Or come along and say, oh, you're a Baptist, so I'll now work through you. Or come along and say, well, your parents wear this, so I'll now work through you. That's not how the Spirit of God works. The Spirit of God comes and he says, are you open to God working in your heart? And so Jesus invites us to look beyond these things, to look at the work of God's Spirit. And ultimately, when you see the gospel writers like Matthew and Luke addressing the illegitimacy of Jesus' birth, they answer it in that way. What they say is, you need to look beyond the externals. You need to look beyond a single pregnant mum, and you need to see the work of God's Spirit there. My appeal to you this morning is, don't let slander, don't let the shaping of perceptions in negative ways stop you seeing the work of God's Spirit through maybe Jesus, if you've been told bad things about Jesus, or through the church, or through his people. But recognize and be open to the work of God, whoever it may be. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you for the way that you responded to your critics, Lord. I thank you that you affirmed the importance of the present versus our origins. Lord, I just pray that we would be people who embody truth. Lord, I pray that we would be a people who don't allow our prejudices to blind us to your work. Lord, that we would be a people who would be always open to your Spirit working through whoever we encounter. Lord, help us to be a people that see and hear the truth wherever it may be found. We ask this in your name. Amen.